First President Trump's Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh has been meeting with individual senators ahead of his confirmation process. No hearing date has been scheduled, but Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says he expects Kavanaugh to get the thumbs up by October 1st. Kavanaugh is Trump's second Supreme Court pick. He would succeed Justice Anthony Kennedy, who announced he's retiring at the end of this month. The move has liberals worried about future rulings and conservatives excited about boosting their influence on the court. According to our next guest, no single justice should be this important. He says one way to minimize that problem would be to have a much bigger Supreme Court. Glenn Reynolds is a professor at the University of Tennessee School of Law and the founder of the InstaPundit blog. He wrote about the court for USA Today. Glenn, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the number 9. It's not actually in the Constitution, as I understand it, when it comes to the Supreme Court, right? We don't have to have 9 members.
No, that's right. In fact, initially it had 6, and then Congress tried to reduce it to 5, and it's varied both above and below the number 9, but it's been 9 for, roughly 150 years, so by custom it's become fairly fixed.
Now, I said there's nothing sacred about the number 9, but you write in this piece we're talking about that we've come to almost treat the U.S. Supreme Court like a priesthood, this sacred institution. You are hoping to change the way we think about that.
Yeah, I think, yes, I am. I think we have done that. I think it's been a mixture of confirmation politics and sort of increased prestige for the learned professions, but the Supreme Court is actually, as one of my law professors at Yale told me, a committee. It's not a sacred body, it's a committee, and it is a committee made up of lawyers. And if you ask yourself, who do I want to put in charge of sort of the great moral issues of my time, a committee made of lawyers might not be the first thing you think of, and yet that's what it is. Now, the other thing about it is that it's pretty unrepresentative of America. In fact, it's even unrepresentative of the legal profession. And, you know, Dahlia Lithwick wrote a piece back before Neil Gorsuch got on the court where she pointed out that they were all a bunch of what she called judicial thoroughbreds, with everybody's from Harvard and Yale except for Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who went to that scrappy Ivy League upstart Columbia University, but only after 2 years of Harvard. And, you know, everybody has these prestigious appellate judgeships before, and literally everyone on the court, and this won't change if Kavanaugh is confirmed, literally everybody on the court, Harvard, Yale, and just so, you know, it's the tiniest fraction of the most upper crust part of the legal profession. And again, that's partly due to confirmation politics. People want a nice, safe brand, and Harvard and Yale are nice, safe brands. But you could think they could reach out a little, at least to, like, you know, Stanford or Michigan or something.
Well, the idea, I guess, might be, okay, the best candidates get in at Harvard and Yale, and then the best of those get in to the minor league of the Supreme Court system, and the best of them make it to the top. So we've got the cream of the cream of the crop here, would be the counterargument. What do you say?
I mean, for certain meaning of best, yes. You know, the law schools test people primarily for having really good LSATs and undergraduate grades when they come in. It's different at Harvard, I think. I went to Yale, where once you're in, you're guaranteed to graduate, basically. You have to really try to screw up. You know, it's nice, and there's nothing wrong with judicial thoroughbreds, except that it's very narrow. And if they were just dealing with technical legal problems, saying, well, they're the best legal minds around, might make some sense, but they keep being called on to function as a sort of set of moral umpires, and I don't know that Ivy League lawyers are the best moral umpires we can produce, and I'm certain they're not the most representative. And plenty of great justices on the Supreme Court didn't have this kind of a background. I mean, Robert Jackson, who was considered one of the greatest minds on the court of the 20th century, actually read law, like Abraham Lincoln, in a lawyer's office. He didn't have a law degree. Of course, many of the earlier justices, that was true. We had people like Earl Warren, who had actually run for election. We have nobody on the Supreme Court who's ever run for election as anything. And so I think, you know, always being in that sort of Ivy League bubble, you're very well-trained in some ways, but you also have a very narrow view of the country. And I thought it was revealing when Gorsuch was nominated, people were talking about how, well, he's going to bring heartland values to the court because he's from Colorado. And, you know, he's from Colorado, but he's a guy who went to Harvard, Yale, and Oxford, and then was a judge in Colorado. So it's not like It's not really some farmer who dropped his plow and went off to the Supreme Court.
Talking to Glenn Reynolds, professor at the University of Tennessee School of Law, founder of the Insta Pundit blog, talking about the U.S. Supreme Court and a piece he wrote in USA Today. Glenn, let's get to your modest proposal here. You want to, if I may use the word, embiggen the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yes. Starting out, my first reflection was that all the hoo-ha over the Kavanaugh appointment tells us something. And what it tells us is that if everything can be turned upside down by a single 80-something-year-old man retiring from the Supreme Court, then the Supreme Court is too sensitive to its input. If one justice can make that big a difference, it probably tells us that the Supreme Court needs to have more justices, so that's less likely to happen. And then my next question was, well, the current system is not very representative, and you could just expand the court, and there are a number of sort of lefty law professors who say that, you know, when we get back in power, we should expand the Supreme Court to make sure there's a reliable leftist majority. But, of course, then Todd Henderson, who's president of the University of Chicago, said, what's to stop Republicans from doing that, too, till we wind up with 1,001 justices on the court? So my proposal was something a little different, and it's sort of semi-serious. I mean, it would take a constitutional amendment, so that limits how serious it can be. My proposal was that we keep the 9 justices we have now, appointed the same way by the president, but then we add one more justice for each state to be appointed by the governor of that state. And my thinking is that, first of all, they'll be more representative. The governors are almost always going to appoint people from their own state, so we'll get some geographic diversity there. We'll get people probably who didn't all go to Harvard and Yale. Who knows? They might have actually even gone to a state law school. I mean, you know, anything could happen. And also, it will mean that when you vote for a president, you're not voting for Supreme Court justices by proxy. I mean, I think you can make a plausible argument. And actually, one of my farthest left colleagues here, I was talking to in the corridor earlier today, who said she really liked this piece, said, you know, I think we got Trump because of the Supreme Court. And I think when you make one of the most important things about a president, who they're going to appoint to the Supreme Court, you then aren't in a position of being able to say, well, who'd make the best president as president? And I think that's a real risk. I think it even plays out in Senate elections to some degree. So by expanding this and giving some of that power to state governors, you sort of diffuse that, and you let the other elected offices do what they're supposed to do instead of being a proxy for the Supreme Court. And the other thing about making the Supreme Court bigger is that not only you make it less sensitive to an individual change here and there, frankly, the Supreme Court doesn't do enough work now. 35, 40 years ago, they heard about twice as many cases as they hear now, and yet the number of cases decided by the courts of appeals was less than a tenth the number of cases that are decided by the courts of appeals today. The Supreme Court is not really providing adequate supervision to lower courts, and if you had that many justices to work with, you could probably set up a system sort of like we have now in the circuit courts, where you have panels and then bigger cases go in bank. And that would provide more supervision for lower courts, which I think would also be good.
So running with this idea, and again, as you say, it's a long shot, you'd have some cases where there's a panel maybe randomly chosen, like, as you say, in lower courts. But you say there would be in bank, which I think means all of them vote. Are we going to have oral arguments in front of, in this case, 59 justices?
Well, you know, how hard is that, really? I mean, that's not that many people. It would mean you'd have to control the questioning a little more than you do today, but it doesn't seem like it's unworkable.
And one other thought, people might say, well, this has the kind of the Senate problem, where California gets to appoint one judges for all of its huge population. Wisconsin, here we get one for our mid-sized population. Alaska, Wyoming, they get one whole justice for their smaller population.
Well, you know, that's true. Take it up with the framers, I guess. I mean, we have states, and there are other things you could do that would address these problems as well. I mean, one solution, honestly, would be to go to an elected Supreme Court, which it's interesting to me to see the change. I mean, one of the things that's happened in the last year, really, is you've seen a lot of people who previously would never have liked the idea now suggesting that, you know, an elected Supreme Court or justices who serve a single 18-year term, maybe that's not such a bad idea. There are probably lots of ways to address some of these problems, and this is only one of them, but I do think it usefully illustrates what's wrong. And I think if you did it, I think it actually would help. I'd rather doubt we'll ever find out.
What do you think of that idea of the 18-year term limit? I've talked to the head of a group advocating for that. Again, another long shot. It would take a constitutional amendment. Do you think that would do something to take to lower the stakes, as you say, in like a presidential election?
I think it would. I think people may be fooling themselves, at least people on the left, if they think it's going to make a big difference in the makeup of the court. I haven't done the research myself, but I saw, I believe it was Jonathan Adler of Case Western, saying that if we had had this for the last 50 years, we would have actually had a somewhat more conservative Supreme Court majority than we actually had. And I think any time you start tinkering with the makeup of the court, thinking you know how that's going to play out ideologically over the long term, you're probably wrong. That there are many things that can change things and frustrate your expectations. So I actually think that's the worst reason to restructure the court, but it is, of course, what motivates the most enthusiasm.
Well, what about it seems like there's an absurdity. I'll say, I don't know about you, Glenn. If I'm 85, I don't want to be conditioning my retirement, assuming I'm still working, on the fate of the free world based on who replaces me and who gets to make that appointment. That gets a little weird.
No, you're totally right. And, of course, we've had some disastrous holdovers where Supreme Court justices stayed well past their sell-by date simply to wait out a president. And, you know, William O. Douglas, who I think is a really underrated Supreme Court justice for his intellect, is partly underrated because he stuck out of the court for 4 or 5 years past when he should have gotten off and was just not very with it during those years. And that sort of, I think, spoiled his reputation. And it's also, again, the two problems of life terms and a smaller Supreme Court make the stakes really high. Whenever a justice retires, the stakes are really high. And the only way I see to get around that really is to make the court bigger. But the 18-year terms are not a terrible idea for addressing that either. I'm certainly not against that proposal.
As we wrap up, Glenn, you've got this conversation starter about this 59-justice idea. But do you think anything's really going to change from our 9-member life appointment court in our lifetimes?
Well, if there's anything I've seen about our political class in the last few years, it's that they're very short-sighted and they have very little self-discipline. And so, unfortunately, it's probably a fairly safe bet that we'll see some sort of lame court-packing scheme followed by some other lame court counterpacking scheme until we wind up with a court of 59 Supreme Court justices, just in a different way. And the only thing I'll say about that is that while I think it's a bad idea and I would oppose it, it would at least dilute the importance of an individual seat somewhat. And if it served to reduce the prestige of the court a little bit and make people think it was something other than God kings, maybe that wouldn't be so bad either, because they are just lawyers.
Glenn, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Glenn Reynolds is a law professor at the University of Tennessee College of Law and the founder of the Instapundit blog. We talked with him about his recent USA Today column about increasing the number of U.S. Supreme Court justices from 9 to 59.